Let's get started. Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here and to give two lectures on bouncing cosmologies to you. Now, there's a really large inflation community out there, the biggest probably. And I remember that during my master's, a couple of years ago, inflation was actually presented as the theory of the early universe. No questions asked. I don't know, maybe we just didn't have enough time to go through any of the problems and alternatives. But it just wasn't part of the course. But I think it's very important because, as you'll see in a moment, inflation does have a few problems. And that's why it's good to work on those, but also investigate alternatives. And of course, if you have any questions, just ask. Okay, so let's get started. What do we know about the early universe? All the information that we have at the moment comes from the cosmic microwave background. So that radiation as measured by Planck and previous satellites actually tells us that the early universe was extraordinarily simple. We have a background. Which is basically flat, homogeneous. I'm going to abbreviate words. If it's not clear, let me know. And isotropic. And then on top of that, we have small fluctuations. Right? And these are nearly scale invariant. And nearly, or maybe even Gaussian. Right. What we also have is our standard model of cosmology called Lambda CDM. I'm sure you've heard about it in the first part of the course. And it's been very successful in describing the evolution of the universe. And what we need, though, for it to be consistent with the state of the universe that we see today, we would have to put in very particular initial conditions. Okay, so you may say, we could just put them in, right? We could just put them in by hand and be done with it. We could go home now. Of course, that's not very satisfying, right? What we actually want to do is we want to describe these, or have a basically a dynamical explanation for these initial conditions. So we want to explain the state of the early universe dynamically. Okay, one of the theories that supposedly does that is, of course, inflation, which you've heard about. But as I said, in the following, I'll just go through a couple of potential problems for inflation, and then we'll talk about bouncing cosmologies as alternatives. Okay, so inflation does not provide a complete history of the universe. What I mean by that is that it doesn't actually make the initial singularity disappear. We basically just push it to an earlier stage. So there's still the problem of the unresolved singularity. And actually, there was a theorem by Borde, Guth, and Wilenking that showed that if you have an ever-expanding cosmology, it's always past incomplete. So we'll always have this problem if all you have in your universe is that it's ever expanding. So it doesn't answer the question what was before. Of course, some people may say, well, it's, you know, that's not what it was designed to do. Of course, you need to put something else in there. But then what do you put there? The second question is, how did it get started? How did we even start inflation? And in fact, when you think about it, the initial conditions that you have to put in for inflation have to be quite special. What you have to do is you have to, if you just draw some kind of standard potential, like, I don't know, plateau, you have to start out somewhere high on the potential with very small initial velocity. Now there's a, that's a EFI. There's an argument by Gibbons and Turok, which quantifies this and shows you that, yeah, the initial conditions are actually very special. And that, of course, somehow clashes with original motivation, right? If inflation was designed to explain the initial conditions that came out of the Big Bang to lead to a universe that we observe today, if you have to have special initial conditions to even get inflation started, what's the point? So that's, there's a Gibbons Turok. If you're interested in any of the papers and you can't find them, just let me know and I'll find them for you. And then there's also an argument by Penrose, where he basically looks at the entropy of the initial state and finds that actually, if you compare that to the entropy that we have in the universe today, it was also quite low compared to today. So, you know, in theory, we would want to have something that explains why the entropy, you know, how to get to a state today. That's called the entropy problem. Okay. Now, another one is that inflation is quite sensitive to parameters. A couple of years ago, the BICEP2 experiment at the South Pole claimed that they had found primordial gravitational waves. They claimed that they had seen gravitational waves that would give you a tensor to scalar ratio of about 0.2. And that was celebrated as the smoking gun of inflation. But then it went away, right? It turned out that the signal they had seen was not actually a signal, but it was produced from dust in our galaxy. So it was basically just a foreground. Then together with Planck, they realized that. And now I think the current R is, I don't know, it's probably even less. Depends on how many sigma you want to give. Something like, I don't know, roughly 0.1. It's less than that, right? So there's no detection yet. But inflation is fine with that, right? I mean, it would have been the smoking gun for inflation, but it's also fine with that. So what that means is that inflation, I mean, we say it's a theory, right? But what it actually is like it's a bunch of different kinds of models. And then depending on what you measure, there will always be a model. You can always cook up a model that will fit, right? And the question is, I mean, you know, proponents would say, oh, but that's great. You know, we'll get the data and then we'll know which model of inflation is correct. OK, that's another way to see it. But I don't know. Something to think about. OK, next point. Is the problem of eternal inflation. Have you guys heard of that already? No? OK. It's basically a runaway behavior that you get when you not only consider the small quantum fluctuations that, of course, here in the field, you know, the small quantum fluctuations, they will either make the field jump a little bit in that direction or a little bit in that direction. And these quantum fluctuations are, of course, the origin of the temperature fluctuations that we see in the CMB. They're the origin of the structure that we see in the universe. And that's all great. But what if you consider larger quantum fluctuations? Of course, they're much, much rarer, but they could happen somewhere, right? The universe is big. So what if you have a larger quantum fluctuation that makes the field go up the potential again. What that means is in the region where that happens, is the field will have much longer to like roll back down and end inflation. So in that region, you'll get much more inflation than in other regions, just because the scalar field has a longer way to go. So you get this region with a lot more inflation, and within that region, that could happen again, right? You have now a really large volume due to what inflation does. It produces large volumes, where you could again get a really rare but large quantum fluctuation. So that process just keeps going, right? You could have, I mean, what you end up with is basically an infinite number of disconnected pocket universes. And in these disconnected pocket universes, because you have an infinite number of them, you actually also get an infinite number of different possible values for the amplitude and the spectrum and the Gaussianity of the perturbations, right? So you basically get everything. actually, I think it was Guth, I might be wrong, one of the inventors of inflation, who said that you will get, I forgot how he phrased it, but you will base everything that can happen will happen an infinite number of times. That's what he said. Okay. Now the problem is, we need an additional measure to regularize these infinities, right? If we predict infinity, then how do we know what we actually predict? Okay. But the problem is that inflation doesn't come with that additional measure, right? It was something extra that we would have to put in. Otherwise, well, if we don't have the measure, as I said, we basically lose all predictive power, and these, let me call them naive predictions that you've heard about, become questionable. So the problem is, so this leads to the measure problem. There are several aspects of this problem. One, for example, is that this maybe easy, simple volume measure that I've just talked about, if you just think about the volume of inflated universes that is created, prefers to produce young universes. Because whenever you have such a large fluctuations, you will always just produce more pocket universes which inflate more. So like the kind of landscape that you end up with is a lot of universes, and most of them are very young, because that's where the most volume is. And pretty sure you've learned in your inflation course so far that you need at least something like 60 e-folds of inflation. So that's not good, right? So the volume measure doesn't work with inflation. It would not predict a universe like we see today, because we don't get 60 e-folds of inflation, but rather much fewer e-folds. Okay, so that measure doesn't work. Of course, there are other measures that you can think of. But then, again, the problem is, even if you find a measure that works, why should that be preferred over, for example, the volume measure, right? There must be some sort of explanation, okay? Right, so something must go wrong here, right? I mean, there are several points where this could go wrong. For example, the fact that you just consider large quantum fluctuations, maybe your theory doesn't actually allow for that, maybe your effective theory, you know, would break down at this point and you would have to replace it with something else. But then what do you replace it with? okay, so several aspects to that problem. Okay, right. So these are, I think, some of the most important ones. Of course, we should somehow work on them and try and resolve them if possible. But also, we should work and look into alternatives, because maybe, just maybe, inflation is not the theory of the early universe. I think I should continue on this side, right? Because you can't see very well now. So that front. Okay, so let me give you a quick overview of bouncing cosmologies. The idea is to replace the Big Bang with a bounce from a initially contracting universe to the expanding universe that we see today. Okay, now expanding means that the Hubble parameter is larger than zero. Contracting means it's less than zero. You remember that H is defined as A dot of A. So what this means is that during the bounce phase, the Hubble parameter has to increase, right? To go from the negative to the positive values. So what we need is H dot larger than zero. Okay, in order to get that, there are actually two options. The first one is to have a non-singular bounce. So we want to find a bounce that we can describe classically throughout, in which the scale factor A goes to a minimum value. So we start out with some large A. During contraction phase, it goes down, becomes minimal, and then just expands again, so it becomes larger. So A would have something like this, and there would be some A min. This framework basically operates within GR, and then we can easily, from the Einstein equations, find that H dot in a flat universe, so for k equal to zero, H is given by just minus a half rho plus p, energy density plus pressure. And then if we just compare these two equations, very simple, we find that that implies that during the bounce, we need rho plus p a negative to k. I don't know if you recognize this, but this basically exactly contradicts the null energy condition that, I don't know, maybe you've seen written down like this. If you just plug in your perfect fluid for your stress energy tensor, you would get rho plus p larger than zero. Okay, so what this means is that during the bounce phase, we have to violate the null energy condition, right? This cannot hold. Okay, now, why would we not want to do that, violate the null energy condition? The problem is that usually a consequence is that you get ghosts, ghost fields. Ghosts are fields with negative kinetic energy. And the reason why this is problematic is that if you have fluctuations in such a field, they would actually lower the energy in the field. So the energy is unbounded from below. It's catastrophic. Okay, so let's just write that down. Ghosts. Thank you. So one of the main concerns then of non-singular bouncing cosmologies is to be able to construct a model where you don't run into ghosts, but you still get a bounce.
Sorry, what fields are we talking about?
Usually you just use scalar fields. There are other bouncing models which use spinners, for example, but scalar fields, I mean, they're the easiest to work with, so that's what people do.
Okay, and a follow-up. It's like this universe that is constructed is filled with this type of scalar fields, no structure, nothing?
You can have structure in there. You can have other stuff in there.
How do you explain that, like the formation of this structure in this universe?
We'll get to that. Good question. Yeah, that's one of the main parts of what we'll do today, actually. Right, I should have said that. Okay, so normally you just work with scalar fields. They're the easiest to deal with. Maths is relatively easy, and they work, so. Same as inflation. I mean, you just write it down with the scalar field. Yeah. Okay. The second option, maybe you can guess, are singular bounces. And singular just means that A actually goes to zero. Right? Here it turns around at the minimal value, which is larger than zero. In these models, A actually goes to zero. That means that our beloved four-dimensional general relativity ceases to be valid. So that's not nice. but then what people in the past have very often done is to just pragmatically match the contracting to the expanding phase by just assuming that GR is valid. And that the actual bounce leaves all your observables unaffected, which you might think, well, that doesn't make much sense, does it? But then, well, it's one of the options that, you know, the only option that in this case you can actually deal with is to assume that nothing weird, catastrophic actually happens. And, you know, from some sort of quantum gravity that would influence the dynamics in this regime. Of course, in addition to these classic, like you could basically call them classical singular bounces, because even though GR is supposed to break down, we just assume it doesn't. But in addition, you can also have, and there have been a few models in the recent past, where you basically get a quantum bounce. Different kinds of models. So we'll see if we have time today, maybe tomorrow. I will show you that they actually either, or they assume some sort of quantum gravity and then try and find how a bounce would work in within that theory. Okay. Right. To come back to your question, most bouncing cosmologies are actually modular. What I mean by that is that you can roughly say there are two phases. First, there's a contracting phase, which solves all the problems that also inflation solves, like the horizon problem, flatness problem, monopole problem, all of that, and makes you gives you the perturbations that we need. And then the second phase would be the bouncing phase, where you just take all of that as an input and see how it goes through a bounce in order to go from your contracting universe to your expanding universe. And what I want to do next is to first look at this contracting phase. And then, probably tomorrow, we'll look into the bouncing phase in more detail. Okay. Good.
That's the board. That's the only.
That doesn't work?
Yeah.
Oh,
that's
so
just stuck up.
Anyone still copying from the other board? Okay,
well,
sorry.
Like, you
sure.
Can
okay.
See up to.
Good. So we'll bring that back down.
People can see like 80% of the board.
Okay, good. Okay. Let me just write down the Friedmann equation. Which relates the Hubble parameter to all the possible energy densities that we can have in the universe. We have cosmological constant, we can have curvature, matter, radiation, and anisotropies. And I've basically written them in terms of their energy density today and the scaling that they have with the scale factor. Have you actually seen this before in the course?
Not the anisotropies.
Not the anisotropies.
Not the last.
Okay. You can write anisotropies like that. If you want to know why it scales like 1 over 8 to the 6, come to me and I'll explain afterwards. OK. So what happens in a contracting universe when A becomes smaller? Which of these terms will dominate? Anyone? Just look at it. When A becomes small?
Anisotropy.
Yes, the anisotropies, of course. So these will become dominant. In inflation, it was the other way around, right? I mean, if you, of course, that will always dominate. But if A becomes, right, I mean, OK. So here, A becomes smaller. And in inflation, A becomes bigger. So you will always have to like make sure that the flatness is somehow achieved by making this term negligible. OK. In 1970, Bilinski, Kolotnikov, and Lifshitz, I write those down. It's called BKL. I'm sure you can look it up. Found that this actually leads to an instability, which we now call the BKL instability. So if you approach the bounce or crunch. So if A goes to zero and the overall volume shrinks, your metric actually becomes highly anisotropic, right, because of this component. And that actually causes the universe to expand along one direction and contract along the other two. And then that kind of oscillates between the directions. So you have a really, they called it chaotic mixmaster behavior. And it would just lead to a catastrophic crunch, right? You wouldn't get a bounce or anything. It would just all crunch, and you would end up with nothing. OK, so we have to do something, right, to make sure that the anisotropies don't dominate when we approach the hopefully bounce. And there is a pretty easy solution, and it's called the ekpyrotic phase. And what we do is we add a scalar field, because that's what we can do. We add it in here. And then it scales like, I have to look this up. Like 1 over a to the 3, 1 plus equation of state of that scalar field that you might have seen in inflation. It's the same thing. You just add a scalar field. This is how it scales. OK, so what do we need the equation of state to be in order to dominate over that when we approach A going to 0? What does W have to be? It's W, not omega, right? I always mix it up. W. Can we do math?
Bigger than 1.
Sorry?
Bigger than 1.
Yes, very good. We need it has to be bigger than 1 so that this exponent is larger than 6, and it will dominate. Okay. Right, and if this dominates, then comparatively the anisotropies get suppressed and we don't run into the BKL instability. This might also be familiar to you. We can write the equation of state in terms of the ratio of the pressure divided by the energy density. And for a scalar field, that's just kinetic energy minus potential energy over kinetic energy plus potential energy. Okay. Right. So let's think about the potential that we need for this to become larger than 1. First of all, we want this to be positive, right? So say we make the potential negative, the numerator becomes positive. And then if we also manage to, for this to still be positive, so for the kinetic energy to dominate over the magnitude of the potential energy, this will also stay negative and it will actually become smaller than the numerator. So that's exactly what we want. We need a negative potential that is actually very steep so that the kinetic energy will be large, right? So that the field rolls down very fast. Kind of the, it's not really a dual, but it's kind of the opposite of what we have in inflation, right? In inflation, you have a positive potential, it's very flat, and you roll very slow. Here you have the opposite. You have something like maybe a negative exponential that always works. And you roll very fast. Does that make sense? That you get W larger than 1 from this? Good. Right, I've already drawn it here. A typical potential would be a negative exponential. So you have minus some constant V naught, and then e to the minus some other constant C times phi. Other potential also work, as long as they fulfill that. You can, of course, quantify that. But this is usually what's being used. It's the easiest, I think. OK. Any questions? Nope. Good. Okay, so let's write down the equation of motion for a scalar field, which is basically just the Klein-Gordon equation. And you know, a lot of these formulae will look very similar to what you know from inflation, just because it's in scalar field in a FLRW universe. It's just that the dynamics will be different, of course. And that's just the derivative with respect to phi. And then from the Friedmann equation, okay, and you can find solutions to these equations for a scale for an ansatz in the scale factor, which we take to be some constant, and then minus t to the 1 over epsilon, where t goes from minus infinity to 0 on the negative side. Right, we're in the contracting phase. We want to say the bounce happens at t equal to 0, Before that, all the times are negative. Okay, and then using these equations, you can find a solution for phi. It's square root 2 over epsilon, and then the logarithm of minus square root epsilon squared v naught over epsilon minus 3 t. Okay. And epsilon, you can relate to the parameter and the potential up there, c. It's just given by c squared over 2. And then we can relate that to the, just by plugging stuff in here, to W. And it's given by 3 over 2, 1 plus W. Okay, so our, we can call it fast roll condition of W larger than 1 translates into this being larger than 3. And similarly to what we do in inflation, we want it to roll really slowly. We also want it to roll really fast. So usually we just, you know, go for the double here. Okay, so that's fast rolling. Okay, so that's the basic dynamics of the background field. What is that? all right. I said that this is called, it's called a scaling solution. And the reason why it's called like that is if you just write everything in terms of this epsilon, you can find that h is 1 over epsilon t. Phi dot is equal to square root of 2 over epsilon 1 over t. And v is equal to minus epsilon minus 3 over epsilon squared t squared. So if you plug these into the Friedmann equation, you can see that all of the different terms all scale like 1 over t squared. That's why it's called scaling solution. Right, let me just note here that because our potential is negative, we don't have the runaway behavior of eternal inflation or something similar here. Because if you just have large quantum fluctuations in this scenario, what it means is that your universe will just contract a little bit more. Oh yeah, I should have said that. I don't think I mentioned that. What we have is very slow contraction, right? That's another thing that's kind of dual to inflation. Instead of fast expansion, we have slow contraction. Oh, didn't write that down. Okay. That's important. So aperiodic phase means slow contraction. To a very first approximation, A is actually constant. It just very slowly contracts. Okay, so the question is, how does a phase of slow contraction solve the puzzles that the standard cosmology throws at us?
There's a motherboard on the other side. The right side actually have 2-3 boards.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's mid. Okay, good. Okay, so let's look at the flatness problem. We know from Planck that the energy density in the spatial curvature, which is given by minus k over a h squared, is very close to zero. I might not have the most up-to-date numbers, but last thing I remember, it was something like this. So that was at some point 2 sigma Planck with baryon acoustic oscillations. Okay. Right, so let's look at how inflation solves the problem and how ekphyrosis solves the problem. Okay, in inflation, A goes like e to the ht, where h to a first approximation is approximately constant. Okay, so this is almost constant. And this grows rapidly. And that, of course, if that grows, drives this to zero. As t goes to infinity. So if your inflationary phase lasts long enough, this will be small enough to fit the observed value. Okay, ekphyrosis, ekphyrotic phase, I wrote it down up there. A goes like minus t to the 1 over epsilon, where epsilon was supposed to be large, right? So this is a very small exponent. So that means that A is actually almost constant. And H, also in terms of epsilon, was given as 1 over epsilon t. And we're assuming some, you know, this is the fast row parameter, so that's something like, I don't know, 10 or 100, something like that. So that means, due to this relation, that h grows rapidly. Okay, and that of course also means that this is driven to zero, with t going to zero from here. Make sense? Good. Okay. Right. So you can equally solve the horizon, the flatness problem in either of these. And yeah, these are actually the only two, well, with a scalar field, the only two phases where you can dynamically solve that problem. Okay, the horizon problem actually becomes kind of trivial because there's enough time for all of the regions to have been in prior causal contact because you extend t to minus infinity. And, okay, so horizon problem. Okay, and the monopole problem, just gonna write it here, it's also very easy. It just doesn't arise as long as the temperature of your Barnes phase is below the temperature of the gut phase. So as long as you ensure that, you're fine. The monopole problem, monopoles come into being when you have a phase transition from a very hot early universe, which was above the gut temperature, to something below the temperature. Right? So if you don't have that phase transition, because you've always been in your evolution below that temperature, then you don't have any monopoles or any other related artifacts.
So the universe has never been that hot.
Maybe not.
Slightly warm universe.
Well, I mean, the gut scale is quite high, so. Yeah. Or we don't even know what it is. I mean, it might not even exist, for all we know. People just assume. Okay.
What T-bounce will be?
It's very model dependent. I'm criticizing inflation for there being like more than 1,000 models probably. It's not so different here. So it depends on the bouncing model that you apply. But yeah, I mean, if you were to have a bounce model which respects that, you would be fine.
I also have a question.
Yeah.
Now that it seems like so dual to inflation, wouldn't you have like some dual problems like the ones you explained from before? For example, the quantum fluctuations you have, couldn't you have those same ones here? Oh no, because they're shrinking, so you wouldn't have enough.
Right, exactly. So that's what I mentioned just briefly. It would just mean that the universe would slowly contract a bit more. And that's fine.
So as the volume is shrinking, you don't have like more probability in that place to do
exactly.
It again and again and again.
Yeah. Because it wouldn't lead to this runaway behavior where you just create volume, more volume, more volume. Yeah. I mean, you know, the whole like eternal inflation thing is a bit, I don't know. I mean, there are proponents of inflation that say, oh, but that's great. You get this landscape of like an infinite number of universes, and we just happen to live in one of them. And then they come with this kind of anthropic reasoning. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, the anthropic principle, basically saying that, we can only live in a universe that provides conditions so that we can actually exist, right? So if we cannot exist in the universe, you know, we don't even have to consider it, right? So it means we end up in the universe like ours because we have to end up in the universe like ours. And then the landscape is fine. Others say, but you know, you have all these string theory wackier, which give you a similar landscape, right? If you compactify your extra dimensions in a certain way, you will end up with certain effective like masses of the particles, interaction strengths, all of that. And you get, you know, you get like a similar outcome, so why not identify the two, and all is good. Yeah, I'm not a big fan, if you're not able to tell. Because to me, it always has this character of like, oh, I'm giving up, you know? I'd rather have like an infinite number of universes than try and explain ours. Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure if you would ask someone who's happy with it, they could explain it much better than me. Okay, so let's look at cosmological perturbations. Okay, so the heuristic picture. we can draw like this. We can again contrast the two, inflation and ekpyrosis. In inflation, because H is approximately constant, we can draw basically the horizon, which goes like 1 over H, roughly, which is like the distance here, is roughly constant if this is time. And then what inflation does is it takes the fluctuations and with time it stretches them. So that at some point your fluctuations are set to leave the horizon, to exit the horizon. In ekpyrosis, the picture looks a bit different because A is roughly constant. Nothing really happens to your perturbations. So we could just draw them, I don't know, like this with time. Roughly constant. But then H, the Haber horizon, shrinks. And it looks something like this. Right, this is your horizon. And you get the same effect, namely that your perturbations leave the horizon. Okay, and when they do that, the quantum fluctuations get squeezed and they become a stochastic distribution of classical density perturbations. I'm pretty sure you've done something like that in your course. I mean, you just look at the, wait, what am I writing? Fluctuations, exit the horizon. Which means they become squeezed. Which means that they become the stochastic distribution of classical density perturbations that are basically the temperature fluctuations that you see in the CMB. Okay, I have 5 minutes, right? I'm not sure I can go through this, but what I want to show is that during an ekpyrotic phase, if you have one scalar field, it actually picks up a blue spectrum. So that's not good. when I say blue spectrum, I mean it's a blue tilt. And we know from the CMB that we should observe a slight red tilt. So the ekpyrotic phase leads to an NS of about 3. Well, it's not an equal sign, roughly. So that's all wrong. I have the calculation here. You could easily see it, that that's the case. Should I try and go through it? Yes, good. okay, let's be quick. Good, let's look at one scalar field. Rewrite it in terms of background value plus perturbations. Background value only depends on time. Perturbations depend on time and space. And then you can, in the ADM formalism, you can write down the metric by decomposing it. We have a lapse N, spatial metric Gij, and the shift Ni. And then the same in the x direction. Okay, and then you can choose a gauge. I'm choosing the theta gauge. which translates into delta phi equal to zero, so that all the physical degrees of freedom go into the spatial metric, which we can write as a squared 1 plus this theta, hence the name. And the theta is actually the co-moving curvature perturbation. Which, as I just said, is the only independent scalar perturbation after gauge fixing. Okay. So we can write down the action that we would get from such a metric. And after many integrations by parts, what you would end up is something with something like this. So minus integral over minus g. Then you have epsilon, which is a constant metric, and derivatives on theta. Okay. And then we can go to Fourier space and to conformal time. Write down the equation for the modes. And it looks something like this, where the dash is a derivative with respect to conformal time. Okay, so the approximate solution is to say, we said A is roughly constant. So we can drop this term. And then the solution is basically just Minkowski. And then we can calculate the two-point function. This is all very, very rough. I think you've done similar calculations for inflation, so I think you know what I mean. If not, ask. Okay, so this is really simple. We just plug it in. A is roughly constant, so we can just ignore it for the integral. And what you're left with is basically an integral k dk, which goes like k squared. Okay, and then, so that's basically the power spectrum. And then the spectral index is defined as 1 plus d log power spectrum, so that's power spectrum, by d log k. Okay, so we have d log k squared by d log k, which is just 2, and that's how you get the 3. Okay, good, or rather not so good, because that's not what we observe. Okay, so here's, I think, you could say one of the biggest drawbacks of the model is that it's not just enough to have one scalar in an ekpyrotic phase, or in the slow contracting phase, then you have a bounce, and then you get a universe like we have today. No, you have to do something to get the tilt correctly. And there are two major options, I would say. One is to add a second scalar field. Well, there are some models that come from string theory, where you basically the one cooked up by Neil Turok and Paul Steinhardt, you have like two brains, they're separated by a fifth dimension and they oscillate, and whenever they collide, that's the Big Bang or the Big Bounce. And you could say, well, there are two scalar fields in this theory already, because one would be the extra dimension, the length of this extra dimension separating the brains, and the other one is the volume modulus you get from compactifying the extra dimensions you get in string theory. So bam, two scalar fields. In just an effective, from an effective viewpoint, yeah, you would have to add a second scalar field. So you could say that makes your model more complicated. What you can also do is you can add, instead of a second scalar field, before your ekparotic phase, you can act a contracting phase dominated by matter. And that actually produces a scalar invariant spectrum. So instead of producing your perturbations during the ekparotic phase, you would say, no, I'm producing them before, and then they would just pass through the ekparotic phase, and they would pass through the bounce phase. That's a scenario called meta-bounce. Robert Brandenburger at McGill is, I think, mainly responsible. there are several options. Question is, which one, you know, do you like best? Or does that mean, oh, but inflation was better all along because you just need one field? I should say in the meta-dominated phase, you don't actually need dust. You could also just have the scalar field in, say, an oscillating quadratic potential or something similar that mimics also the equation of state of W equal to zero, which is what you would need for the scalar invariant spectrum. There are several options. But yeah, this is the gist of it. Okay, I think we should stop here and talk about the bouncing phase tomorrow.